I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at Adam Savage's Workshop Cave in San Francisco for a conversation about the upcoming Silicon Valley's premier Comic Con. Tune in for a fascinating commentary by Silicon's creative director Adam Savage, executive director Trip Hunter, award-winning model maker Fawn Davis, and artist Jen Schechter, who all jump in with Adam for a rollicking and mesmerizing repartee. Come along and join the party. Adam Savage, ready to rock and roll?
Ready to rock and roll.
All right. Before we get going, tell us about where we are. This is a mind-blowing, literal cave in San Francisco.
We are in my cave in the Mission District of San Francisco. I've had many shops over my lifetime. This is without a doubt the longest one I've had, 11 years now, and it's my favorite. It's a couple thousand square feet, a couple blocks from my house.
So if somebody could go inside Adam Savage's brain, this is what it would look like.
It is. And clearly what you see when you're in here is that I'm a high functioning hoarder and it is a tile puzzle. The only reason we can actually sit here is because I had a shoot here last week and I had to get rid of a bunch of stuff. But it's a constant battle. Mm-hmm. I have a storage space a block away. I realize I have this issue in that I can't stop making things and I can't stop collecting things. And I don't have a pathology of getting rid of stuff. And I need to add that to my repertoire.
Or add that to the square footage of the cave.
Yeah, and that's going to come at a premium in San Francisco.
Yeah, it is. You live right nearby.
Yeah, I live a couple blocks away.
So this is the equivalent of your garage.
It is, and it's really, really dreamy. When I'm in television production, I'm able to be in this shop maybe a few hours a month. But since COVID, I've been doing 40 plus hours a week in here.
So that means more things have been created in here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we went from releasing on Tested, my YouTube channel, we went from releasing one or two videos every week to 7 videos a week. So hundreds and hundreds of hours over the last couple of years.
And thematically, what do your YouTubes focus on?
It's on making.
And could be anything.
Anything. My definition of making is as broad as I've been able to make it, which is anytime you use your point of view to make something from nothing. It doesn't have to be a physical thing. It can be temporal. And so, yeah, I've done everything from shop infrastructure. Actually, the day after Thanksgiving, I came in here and did a 45-minute piece to camera about how I had learned and realized that there's no such thing as a measurement. And that was one of our most popular videos in the last 6 months.
Explain that.
Well, I spent a lot of time here over COVID dialing into my machine tools, my mill and my lathe. And a mill and a lathe are effectively, if society collapsed, you could rebuild them with these two tools. And I became a more refined machinist. I did what a machinist would call chasing zeros, getting to more and more precise refinement. And in that, I started reading papers about refinement of measurements and how at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution around the Well, not at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but around the turn of the last century, somebody realized that we didn't have an agreement on what an inch was.
Oh, interesting.
And so they developed a thing called gauge blocks, which were a standard that shops could buy. And then you knew if you made a part to a spec that it would match the part that I made to a spec. But gauge blocks are certified to an incredibly precise degree within nanometers, but only at a specific temperature. And when I started reading into that, it turns out that at 68 degrees Fahrenheit, it's plus or minus, 12 nanometers as an inch. But at 70 degrees, it's plus or minus 20 nanometers. And holding on to the gauge block for more than a few seconds, I'm adding my body heat to it. I'm changing its measurement. So I realized like a thunderbolt that all measurement is simply a compromise of circumstance. We're agreeing on those circumstances, not on the measurement.
How fascinating. You made me think, I was in Germany and there's a 12th century church and out front was a carved loaf of bread that gave everybody, this is the length and dimension of,
Oh, amazing. Yes, exactly. And I love the idea that the precision comes out of the necessity to agree. Right? Like world time, separating the globe into 24 time zones, that came about because of trains. Because trains were moving too fast between the capitals of Europe. And for the longest time, Paris was like 2 hours and 14 minutes behind London. And India had like 600 time zones. And as soon as we started traveling with trains, we needed something more precise to keep track of each other.
How fascinating.
So, again, I've done everything from building shelves in here to building sculptures inspired by Moby Dick to talking about engineering like that.
That's so cool. So, it's so hard to stay focused with you.
Yeah.
Because everywhere I look, I mean, there's Star Wars, Darth Vader helmets. To the right, fascinated by the NASA space suit. And somebody said, you made that?
Well, so actually, yeah, I've been building, replicating, and collecting spacesuits for about 25 years now. But this one on our side here is the first time I've designed and built one from scratch.
Has NASA contacted you?
Well, I have a lot of friends over at NASA, and I have a long and wonderful relationship with some astronauts and some of the techs at Johnson Space Center and at the Smithsonian. So it's a long-term relationship I have with NASA.
Tell us about, like, the helmets. Why are they here? Did you design those?
No. Most of these are helmets from movies. We've got, like, samurai helmets, Kylo Ren Star Wars helmets, diving helmets. I realized that my obsession with spacesuits is actually equivalent to my obsession with armor and, as well, safety gear. Every time we needed a piece of safety gear on Mythbusters, I researched and bought the best version I could afford of that safety gear. And I realized that spacesuits, armor, and safety gear are all the same thing. They're human beings engineering our own hermit crab shells.
the fact
that we can engineer it makes us, for better or worse, the most successful species on the planet. And I find that really inspiring.
Over your shoulder, tell us about that.
The armor there?
Yeah.
That is a brand new piece I just collected. Mm-hmm. That is a replica of Colonial Marines armor from Aliens. But this set was actually hammered out of aluminum by the original maker of the armor for Aliens. His name is Terry English.
Wow.
Back in 2017, I got to go to his shop in Cornwall, England, and apprentice under him for 10 days while he made me a suit of Arthur's armor from Excalibur, one of my all-time favorite movies.
That's so cool. Do you do CNC work?
I occasionally have a need for CNC work, but I farm it out. For myself, I prefer hand machining everything. Mm-hmm. I just like the practice and the meditative.
Tactile, yeah. Direct.
Yeah.
Very fascinating.
There's a deep endorphin rush for me of getting precise with things.
Mm-hmm. For a moment, roll back in time.
Okay.
In your life. Where were you a kid? And were you a geek always?
Oh, yeah. No, I've always... So I'm the son of an artist and a psychologist. I was born and raised in New York City in Tarrytown, New York. And I was always encouraged to try different things, to make my own toys. And whenever I was really interested in something, my parents made efforts to put that in front of me. And I followed that same thing with my kids, who are now adults. But yeah, the environment I grew up in was a very creative one.
So you get out of high school back in New York, then what happens to your life?
I go to NYU and study acting for 6 months.
Wow.
At the NYU Tisch School for the Arts in the experimental theater wing. And then I dropped out. I ended up getting a kind of an ersatz film education because all my friends at NYU were in the film department and I art directed films with them and I worked as PAs on their productions. It's that's a whole plasma pool you jump into and mm-hmm. don't leave for a few years. And that eventually led to working in theater and then in special effects here in San Francisco.
So when you came to San Francisco, who hired you? What were you doing?
So I was in New York. It was 1989. I was working as a graphic designer, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I submit that New York is a terrible place to be if you don't know your ambition. It will chew you up and leave you by the side mm-hmm. of the road. San Francisco is a phenomenal place to be if you don't know what your ambition is. So I moved out here because I've always loved this city.
Did you have a job when you came?
No. I moved into one of my closest friend's apartments, and I got a job in theater. And that job led to being trained as a rigger, as a carpenter, as a stage painter. And that ended up leading to special effects, but none of it was planned. I came here thinking that I wanted to be a sculptor. And so I came out with a bunch of sculptures. I made some new ones and I put them in group shows. And this is what was great about San Francisco in the early 90s. There was all these tiny little galleries, all these little black box theaters. There's plenty of room for someone like me who was just sort of finding their skills to try them out.
And you were able to pay your rent and make a living.
Not only pay my rent and make a living, but there was a point after 4 or 5 years in theater and then moving into film, I noticed something, which was once I was in commercial special effects production, I was no longer going home and spending all night working on my shop. And I examined it and I realized it was because I was getting the creative satisfaction from the work. The work was challenging me, the problem solving was challenging me enough that I was getting my creative needs met. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this is what a career is. When your creative needs are met in the service of commerce, that's a career. The special effects industry is packed with people who say, I used to be an artist. And I really made a key decision. I was never going to say that because we're all artists.
We're exactly, by default.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, game changer. What happened? Television.
So I have been a freelancer my whole life. As a freelancer, I'm always wondering what's next. And so around 2002, I was flying back and forth to New York to develop a kids' television show called Mr. Nighttime that never came to fruition. But at the same time, Jamie Hyneman, who I worked for in the 90s, called me up and he said, hey, I just got a call from Television Network. They want to make a show called Mythbusters. You want to help me make a demo reel? I think we could make a fun demo reel together. And what Jamie didn't know is that I had just bought myself the first laptop built for digital video editing, the Pismo by Apple. And I had bought a little digital DV camera, and I spent the spring of 2002 teaching myself the rudiments of filmmaking. And so when Jamie called, I had this everything I needed. I showed up, we filmed for 2 hours. Actually, I will tell you, I remember coming back to my apartment and starting to digitize the footage. And I was watching Hyneman on camera, and I thought, the camera really loves Jamie. Like, I now understand what that means. Like, I can't stand to hear him talk, but on camera, he's really interesting. And we sent that demo reel to Discovery, and they showed up 3 weeks later to film the pilots of Mythbusters, and we didn't stop filming until the late fall of 2015.
Why did it end?
The ratings were going down. We had reached the other side of our bell curve distribution, and we were tired. We made the show for 13 and a half straight years. I was in my 30s when I started.
If looking back, what segment, what show first comes to mind?
The high points for me of making Mythbusters are the moments when I understood my job at a deeper level. So in the very first season, it was a free-for-all. I had no idea what I was doing. No one said anything to me about hosting except try and wear the same thing every day. That was the only instruction I got. And we were filming a myth about, will a penny thrown from the Empire State Building kill you when it hits the ground? We had this beautiful bit of math from a NASA scientist about how a penny has two different terminal velocities, one on its face and one on its edge. And I thought, on the plane home from New York, from filming at the Empire State Building, I thought, I have a point of view about this. And I don't like the idea of a piece to camera about math. Not that I have an issue with math, but there must be a better way to physicalize the terminal velocity of a penny. So I started researching it, and I couldn't find the experimental setup that I wanted, so I built it. I built a wind tunnel that had two speeds, and the theory was if I got the speeds correct and I dropped a penny in the top, because it had two different terminal velocities, it would tumble up and down in this tube. And I built a tube, and I put the penny in, and I'm getting goosebumps as I tell you this, because it did exactly what I hypothesized, and I understood the deep endorphin rush that has propelled science since we've been living in caves. That was a moment at which I realized I had something genuine and abiding to contribute to this show.
What a trip. What a paradox. A penny.
Yeah.
You know, a little tiny object.
Just the idea of conceiving what it ought to do and then having it do that. Was so thrilling. To date, you know, I've interviewed and been around thousands of scientists. I have never met one who does not love their work.
That's really cool. So Mythbusters goes away.
Yeah.
How do you reinvent yourself?
Just before we wrapped Mythbusters, I was hanging out with a friend of mine who was an actress on one of the CSI shows. She had been on it for 6 years and then left. And she said, oh, sweetie, your show is ending after 13 years. Get ready because you're going to go insane. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, the life change will be really weird. And she was right. Right after we finished, I kept up a kind of feverish pace because that was the pace I had been doing things forever. And it took about a year for me to find a different pace. You know, my wife was like, do you have to bolt to the cave every day at 8 a.m.? And I was like, actually, no. And so now I go and get coffee around 9. I come in here around 9:30. It's a much more relaxed existence, but I had to learn that.
So in a new incarnation, Silicon.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Silicon started as the first homegrown Bay Area con in a while. Steve Wozniak brought it to Silicon Valley in a few years. We went to every Silicon as tested, and I went in costume, and we built a really lovely relationship with the con. And then back in 2019, the con invited me to come in. And that felt, I think, both Trip Hunter runs the con and to me, like a really natural extension of the friendship, the professional relationship, and the overarching goals we had, which was promoting letting people find their freak flag and mm-hmm. flying it.
So it's to share.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I turned 50 5 years ago and my kids moved out of the house and I'm in that stage of my life where I can see that I'm on my long decline, right?
<yeah. laughs>
Maybe it's 40 more years. I hope it's 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, as soon as I felt that, I felt a real abiding need to pass on everything. You know, I love the cosplay community specifically because it is so deeply sharing based. And same thing with the maker community. That wasn't natural. That wasn't the way it started. There was a lot of gatekeeping in the early days of both movements, making and cosplaying. But I feel like the kindness won out.
Mm-hmm.
And at Silicon, we consider it one of our primary missions to promote that sharing and to reduce the gatekeeping until the threshold to entry is as close to zero as we can make it.
Talk to us about cosplaying as it relates to people that come to Silicon.
Okay. Actually, I'd like to talk about cosplay as it relates to all humans
for
a second.
Yeah, there you go.
Because anyone listening who's heard the term cosplay probably has an opinion that it's a little weird. Mm-hmm. And I want to point out that everyone listening has a favorite shirt or jacket or pair of shoes that when you put them on, life feels a little better. And that's all that cosplay is, just at a bigger scale.
Right.
The transformation I felt the first time I put on a costume when I was 10 years old, I dressed up as Fonzie from Happy Days. I felt, well, someone pointed out that because I only had a jean jacket, I was officially Chachi. But that transformation altered me and still continues to. And I've spent a long time both enjoying it and also examining it. And I think that as human beings, we are a couple of things. We are explorers and we're storytellers. We go to the edge of the known and we report back what we find. And the stories that move us, wherever they are, when we cosplay, we're literally pouring our bodies into those stories. And we're learning what we can about ourselves and about those narratives by doing that. And so at Silicon, the cosplayers that come show so much of a breadth of creativity and genius. And
give us some visual.
Yeah, the first cosplay that ever really shifted my whole understanding was I was at San Diego Comic-Con around about 2010, and I ran into a Hello Kitty Darth Vader, bright pink. And I thought, oh, wow, I really understand something I didn't before. These mashups of, like, how do I take this and make it my own?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's one thing to dress up as Darth Vader. That feels great. I've done that. But it's another to think, what does Darth Vader mean to me and where can I take it? That's a whole nother thing. So you get both at any given con. And it's so much fun to be on the floor of ours and watching people walk around. Also, when you've invested in a costume and you run into someone else wearing the same costume, you share an intimacy with them.
A brotherhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know if you've ever hung out with someone you grew up across the street from but weren't friends with, but just growing up in the same location links you, and the costume work does the same.
Over your shoulder?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, that's No Face. One of my favorite filmmakers in the world is Miyazaki, the Japanese animation director. His film Spirited Away has always been one of my top five favorite films. And I like to joke that there's at least 25 films in my top five, but that one's absolutely in the top five. And No Face is, he is both almost a villain and almost a hero of the movie.
And you wore that, right?
Well, so one of my first transformative cosplays was dressing up as him at San Diego Comic-Con, and I actually had No Face tries to get people to make friends with him by giving them gold. And so I secreted some gold coins in my gown. And when people asked for pictures, I would silently acquiesce to the picture, but then I'd give them a gold coin. And then people started giving me my gold coins back. Wow. And I didn't understand it until I realized that in the movie, it's bad luck to take No Face's gold. And so what was happening here on the con floor was a kind of theater in which there was no audience and there was no performers. We were all part of the same mix. So about 10 years later at New York Comic Con 2 years ago, I decided to make No Face have the mouth that he eats everything with.
Unknown caller.
Unknown caller.
least that was you.
So about 10 years later, I decided to tackle No Face again, and this time to give him a mouth. In the film, he gets a mouth about halfway through the film, and he becomes ravenous and starts eating everything in the movie. And so I tasked my shop assistants with making a bunch of things for No Face to eat. And you can see these surreal fish hanging out above us from the ceiling. These are all things that I ate as No Face while walking around New York Comic Con.
That's really cool. Is No Face retired?
No Face is retired right now. But I just love looking at him. He has a real place of pride here in the cave because he's so important to me.
That's really cool. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more in specifics about Silicon.
Yeah.
That's coming up. This is real.
Yeah, Silicon is coming up. It is the last weekend in August, the 27th and 28th at the San Jose Convention Center.
And do we want to have Trip jump in at some point?
Yeah, by all means. Let's wheel Trip up. Trip up.
Let's unpack it.
No, I love this chair.
This is Trip Hunter, the CEO of Silicon.
Hello.
Hey, Trip. As you know, we're just talking about an upcoming event. Tell us about it.
It's an incredible event. One of the things we try to do that makes our event a little bit different is to come up with a theme for it every year. And I don't think there are a lot of cons out there that do that. And our theme this year is creating the improbable. And so much of what Adam's been talking about is this ability for people who come to be able to leave feeling empowered. Right, feeling that they now can take the first step in creating on their own. And I think that's a really important component.
Yeah, we want to stake out a claim as the Maker's Con. Mm-hmm. All cons are Maker's Cons, absolutely.
But this one, you have classes.
Not only do we have classes, we're actually going to devote a whole portion of the floor, a significant percentage of the floor, to a makerspace where we will have classes, workshops, demonstrations, hour-long contests. What can you do with a coat hanger in a couple of hours with cardboard? You know, when I meet people who want to cosplay but haven't yet, they always say, I just haven't figured out the right thing. I don't think I have the right skills. I don't know if I have the right materials. And I want, again, to lower the threshold to entry so that they take that leap.
That being said, have you had people show up that almost arrived by accident who were clueless and were transformed by coming?
Interesting. That's a really good question. I'm not sure about that. I will tell you there is a kind of costume I see at cons all the time, which is the person who is like, I'm going to a con, and they grab some things they have around the house and they scotch tape some things on themselves. Like maybe it's a Captain America star on their chest or something. But the people who are doing that, who are doing a genuinely crappy thing, but they're doing it because they want to play.
Because that passion.
Yes. And that to me speaks so much volume about what we're all getting out of that experience.
So that being said, that person might go to the next level.
Absolutely.
Because of the expert that's doing the class training.
And they might worry that like someone will make fun of them because their costume isn't amazing, but that's not going to happen. You're going to run into people who are like, dude, yeah, Captain America. Yeah.
And we were recently talking to a very interesting person, Jonathan Knowles. He used to be with JPL, and he was saying the maker definition is much broader than most people define it. Like a woman or a man knitting a scarf, they're a maker, right? And you need to be able to embrace all of those different platforms that people are passionate about.
Sewing is making. Gardening is making. Coding is making. I had a guy come up to the autograph. I used to speak at the San Mateo Maker Fair every year. And I would always sign autographs for 2 or 3 hours afterwards. And a guy came up and I said, what are you making lately? It's a question I ask everybody. He said, I don't make, I code. And I yelled, coding is making. And he burst into tears. Again, like, we're all part of the same journey.
It's interesting that it's part of the human condition, that drive, that need, even for the kid gushing with the sand on the beach, you know, they start out, they're making.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these things at the end of our arms, these collection of bones, our hands, are unbelievable. They're amazing devices evolutionarily, mechanically.
Even if you don't have all of them.
Even if you don't have, I almost lost this one over COVID.
I had a near capitation of my baby finger, and it's all splinted up, and I come in the lumber yard and go, yeah, dude, me too. There are all these guys that you
never... That's my resume.
Yeah, yes. They had no thumb or missing a couple. You never noticed.
It's indeed.
War wounds.
Yeah. I have a folder on my computer. It's just pictures of my injuries. It's not for the weak of stomach. But I always wanted to chronicle. And one of my sons is a cook. And as a cook, he lacerates his hands on the occasion. And he always sends me a picture because he knows I want to collect the archive.
That's really fun. A little bit more about Silicon coming up. August
27, 28.
Mm-hmm. August 27, 28. Not too far off.
Yep. San Jose Convention Center.
So like any given pop culture con, we're going to have celebrities there. They'll be taking pictures. They'll be doing panels. But we're also going to have, like we said, we're going to have maker panels.
Yeah, going a little over. Bit more about in detail about the makers, about what somebody could learn to do there.
Oh. Well, you know, step back for a second, and we've been doing virtual maker events online. So we had one last weekend with Sophie Wong, a great maker, and she built a cyberpunk helmet. And you purchase a kit for $40, get it mailed to your house, and then you go online. And she spent 3 hours walking 40 or 50 people through an online maker. So we're taking that kind of virtual experience and bringing it into a physical experience in this huge makerspace on the floor. That's also surrounded by companies who are 3D printers who will be doing demos, you know, in their booths on how to 3D print objects. And you'll be able to, you know, actually do something in their booth, which is really cool.
To actually make something.
Yeah.
NASA will also have a big presence at the con, as they did last year. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to have a couple of astronauts do panels.
Oh, wow.
We're still working on that.
So would NASA have a makerspace where they...
NASA won't have an official makerspace in their booth at the con, but NASA is very much understands that the makers are the future. Like, they totally lean into that. Yeah.
And their content is geared towards... So they're doing a lot about Artemis this year, mm-hmm. And how do you convert, you know, water on the moon into hydrogen? How do you make jet fuel out of it so we can get to Mars? So it is maker, but it's on a little bit different level.
Well, in fact, the spacesuit you were asking me about earlier is inspired. Yeah. The structure is actually the structure of the NASA Artemis suits, and that you enter through the backpack, and thus you could actually have the suit be outside your habitat and never enter the habitat because of the way they've mechanically designed it. It's kind of a brilliant solution.
Interesting. That suit is the materials fabric based on the same? No,
it is simply a prop that looks like a spacesuit. It couldn't possibly be worn in space. But, you know, someday I hope to put one on and go to space. A real one.
And even like the glass, did you make that?
I had that blown by a company down in Los Angeles. So they blow hemispheres, and if you give them a weird shape, they can blow plastic in that one too.
That's really cool. Could the public ever come to your cave?
I have had fundraisers here. Huh. I've had parties here. But... really, no. I need to work here mostly quietly and mostly alone. But that's not to say that I don't want, at some point, a gallery space where I can put some of these things on display.
That's exactly what I'm thinking is you're to the rafters, to the gills.
Oh, no, it's, yeah.
And how cool it would be to have another space where you could showcase.
There's a commercial space on the corner here that's available, and I was planning on calling them next week and finding out how much it was just to see if I could set up a little gallery around the corner.
We had the museum last year.
Yes, we brought a bunch of my props down to Silicon last year, and we're going to do that again this year.
Oh, cool.
And the great part about that is that because people have watched me build a lot of this stuff on the YouTube channel, they get to come to the con and see it in person.
Touch it,
yeah.
You know, but it's also worth mentioning that we have a lot of the traditional elements of the con, right? So for, you know, celebrities, Christopher Lloyd is coming, Alan Ritchton is coming from the Amazon show
Reacher,
which is pretty cool.
And you get to talk and hang out with these people.
Very
accessible.
Make no mistake, the green room at any given con is one of the most fun places to be. That's where I met Nichelle Nichols and Mads Mikkelsen, Bill Shatner. Yeah, the green rooms are really, really fun.
That's really cool. And how many people, I know everything's been weird and sideways because of COVID.
Yeah.
What do you estimate attendance this year, 2022?
So we're trying to compromise. I think after last year with COVID, we just wanted to have a heartbeat, right? We were limited to 5,000 people a day, which meant we had 1,500 people who were working in the building. So 3,500 lucky people got to show up in a massive massive space. The building holds 30,000 a day, but I think we're going to try to hit about 15,000.
Mm-hmm. Could there be a blessing, an upside blessing, by having reduced body count?
100%. In fact, actually, last year, a lot of the attendees said the con felt intimate in a really special way. And we wanted to service that this year. We didn't want to go full bore again because we like that intimacy. And our vendors actually said that people had more time to talk to them about their wares at the smaller con than at a larger one. Mm-hmm. So I think, as Tripp said, there is a sweet spot, and it's not just the most number of people you could pack into a space. It's really about the quality of the experience.
Isn't it fascinating the breadth of reality checks that we've gone through because of COVID? A lot of lessons learned.
It has provided a control against which to compare lots of the aspects of our existence.
And it also gets back to one of the maker realizations is that you can learn from your mistakes. Right. And so we learned, I don't think we would have ever put on a con and said, let's have half the capacity.
Right.
But it feels like it will be the right number of people. Yeah. You know, I make cutting boards. I dropped one on the floor once and it broke in half. And now that size is my new favorite size to be right.
That's great.
That's funny.
My name is Fawn Davis. I run a studio in Los Angeles, California called Fonco Studios. I have been a special effects artist, miniature maker for over 25 years, worked on over 40 feature films, and been a longtime friend with Adam Savage here.
Tell us about some of the things that you focus on, your passion, some of the things you're most proud of.
Oh, man. For me, it's hard to summarize. Adam and I, one of the reasons we're probably really good friends is we have a lot in common in that we really enjoy making everything. So for me, it's I want to make the things that I really enjoy seeing other people make, I guess. And then, but I want to make things I've never made before. I guess that's the overriding kind of driving force behind what I do.
Right in the here and now, what is a challenge in your brain of something you would like to make?
It's funny, everything that I want to make, I actually just make it. Like, I have no boundaries when it comes to, like, the things that I want to make. So I don't have those kind of, like, oh, I really wish I could make this or that. There are, like, franchises that I wish I could work on. Like, right now I'm customizing my bicycle to look like a light cycle. That's my latest hobby is illuminating my bicycle in a way that it cannot be missed at night when I ride. It's an example of many things that I get obsessed about.
And that's practical.
It is very practical, yes.
My name is Jen Schachter, artist, a maker, a project manager, and I work with the folks at Tested. I work very closely with Adam, and I'm running kind of all the maker components of the Silicon event. I went to art school, so I have kind of a fine art sculpture, painting, drawing background, but I found that the practice of being a solitary studio artist was very lonely. And one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the maker community is that it's collaborative and this sharing aspect. Everyone's kind of sharing knowledge and building something where a bunch of different people's talents and expertise come together to make something that no one individual could make by themselves.
You're going to be at Silicon, right? And you're going to be doing workshops?
Yeah, we've been running a series of virtual workshops kind of to get everybody warmed up. And that's been really lovely because everyone has been so isolated throughout the pandemic. Like, basically, it's this little window into everybody's sitting at their desk with their computer open and they're following along on a build. But it's just this, like, I don't know, this little community. It's like a workshop jam from everybody's remote areas across the country. And we're hoping to bring that into the makerspace at the con. What we've been seeing with the virtual workshops is the excitement that people have just about connecting with each other again. Like, everyone that I know that's in the con realm and cosplay realm has been sad that we miss all of these events because it's such an opportunity to connect with your fellow makers and to, like, show off what you've been obsessing about. And that has been missing for this whole time that the cons have been, you know, not happening because of COVID. We're really hoping to get that collaborative, like, everybody's hanging out, jamming, making an object together. That spirit of excitement is what we're looking forward to.
I want to add something to what Jen's just said, which is, there's an aspect of these virtual workshops, and you can find this on our website, siliconsj.com. The workshops we do help people build a framework for something, but then they detail it however they want. Mm-hmm. And what we end up with is a gallery of all the attendees, each of their different, unique, aesthetic versions of what we've shown them how to build. And those gallery, they demonstrate such a massive breadth of aesthetic excursion that they're crazy inspiring. Am I right? We almost, like, get choked up when we look at the gallery after our workshop the first time because it's telling the whole story we want to tell about what is possible with making.
Jen, tell us about more tangible, hands-on. What are some of the things you're going to teach us there that we can do?
Yeah, I think the main focus, there'll be a set of different demos. So people that are sort of pro cosplayers will show us different techniques like how to work with EVA foam or what to do with a rotary tool or different finishing techniques. So we'll have demos throughout the con at different times with like a pro explaining that process and kind of letting people get hands-on. But the other thing we're really excited about is this kind of open-ended build challenge. And we did this last year as well, where we gave them a box of materials, pretty open-ended, and just said, make something that can fit on your head, something that's wearable. It could be a mask, it could be a helmet, it could be ears, whatever you want. And you have the weekend to make it using only the materials that come in this box.
And how about the equipment that to utilize to make?
It's pretty low tech. We want to keep everything accessible. There's a pretty wide age range of people that are, you know, participating. So we have young kids up to, you know, very obsessed, like really long time makers. So we pretty much are giving them like cutting tools, gluing tools, and some finishing tools like paint and, you know, little detail things that they can add. But primarily it's foam, and they're just cutting and gluing things together and creating something that they can wear.
Looking back, can you guys think of an oh my god thing that some of these people made that were really surprising?
The bird, right? This one woman made it was like a peacock.
That's right.
And it was lit up and it came down, and then she built a dress around the headset and the peacock came into the dress. And then the dress just picked up the theme and went all the way to the ground. So you couldn't tell where the headset ended and the dress began. It was.
And if I remember correctly, we were wondering how she found so much volume. And she had used the box we'd shipped the materials in as well as all of the materials. And that's the kind of thing you're like, wow.
Yeah. That the one woman's mask had, she'd cut the soda can in half. Right, and then filled it with water, so it looked like she was breathing water. Do you remember that one? Wow. It was just mind blowing. Adam and I were like, I could have never figured that out.
I love looking at things and thinking about how they're made. And when we saw that very first gallery, at least half of the things I was like, I don't know how they did this.
Yeah. I think it's one of the most rewarding things about doing education is giving people the tools to be creative and seeing what they do with it.
Yeah.
Because I can promise you, every class that I've ever taught, every student has come up with something 100% unique in a way that was not predictable. And that is so much fun.
Have you learned things from the people?
Absolutely. Everyone approaches a project differently. Every single individual approaches it with a different perspective, different life experience. And so they come up with a creation that you yourself could never imagine. I don't think it's even possible to predict.
So thinking out of the box, that they don't know where the box is, they might come up with a solution that you would never think of.
That is absolutely true. Yeah, oh, no. And it's the most fun part about education, for sure.
When Fawn and I were working at the ILM model shop, that was one of the things that was really great, is that you'd be executing a project and someone would come up and tell you how they would execute it. And it would be totally different. Or two people would be doing this, working on the same project, coming out with things that look totally different because they had different executions of them.
Yeah, every time you learn to use a tool, you would always think about, how else can I use this tool? And how can I use this tool in a way that no one has designed it to use that way? And we came up with, as a group, as a collective, we came up with so many really innovative ways of using different tools, materials, and techniques. Those are the three things.
Yeah.
So much fun.
You were talking earlier about using high-tech machining tools, but you don't have to have that, right? You can do the process with, like you said, scissors and glue. And
so one of a regular collaborator of mine is a spacesuit builder named Ryan Nagata. And Ryan started out making props. And when he came to visit me at the cave, he looked at my lightsaber collection. I have a whole cabinet full of lightsabers over there. And he said, these three I made. And I was like, really? You don't have machine tools? He's like, no, I filed them. And they are magnificently done, and they're all made with a bandsaw and a hand file. No machine tools whatsoever. No, there absolutely is no equipment threshold to entry.
Yeah, just going back to cosplay for a second, something that I wanted to share was, when I moved to Los Angeles, I discovered theme parties. which basically everyone goes in cosplay to these parties. And I'd never experienced that before. And it was the most fun thing ever because cosplay, you know, there's this whole transition from when I was a kid, it was only Halloween you were allowed to dress up. And then as an adult, there were Halloween parties. And then, but that was it. Once a year, you got to dress up.
The superhero party.
Yeah. And then the convention started to happen. Cosplay started to happen. So you can now, you have permission as an adult to go to conventions and dress up in costume. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, it moved to the next level, which was theme parties. And what I learned is, you know, most of the time when I was invited to a theme party, I had a couple nights to run to the store and just kind of dream up some idea for a costume. And that, I think, is the big secret. You don't need months to prepare a costume. You just need to get a little creative. Once it was an Indiana Jones party, I went and bought 2 red scarves and a black shirt, and now I was a swordsman. I figured that out at the store that night. That's a good example. There's a lot of ways to cosplay. There's a lot of ways to participate in these conventions without spending, you know, don't be intimidated, you know. Don't feel like you have to spend months. You can, and it's very rewarding, but you don't have to.
As you could imagine, the Industrial Light and Magic Halloween party exhibited some pretty spectacular costumes. But one of its predecessors was the CWI Halloween party. And Jamie Heineman once won the CWI Halloween party contest with a costume that costs $1.
And the CWI?
CWI, Chris Wayless Industries. CWI was a special effects shop up in Novato that did Gremlins and Naked Lunch and a bunch of Cronenberg's films. Jamie Heineman worked for them, and he went to their Halloween party. He didn't know what he was going to do, so he took some red chalk from a chalker, a carpenter's chalk line. He rubbed it all over his bald head, and then he put several rubber bands around his head, and he went to the party as a roast. And he looked exactly like a roast. And he won, and it cost $1.
I thought you were going to say he went as a fire.
Yeah. That's great. More?
Well, I think just building on the this idea that like cosplay is kind of for everyone, like wearing costumes and dressing up is for everyone. And there's this really, I don't know, everyone has this need when you create something, I think, for it to be seen, for other people to witness it and to engage with it. And that's one of the really beautiful things about the con is like everybody's been building their stuff either for months or they just made it last night or in their hotel room. But everybody comes together and there's this like parade of everybody sharing the excitement of this thing that they've just created. It's like a presentation of your passion, like the presentation of this thing you've been obsessing over.
It's so interesting that you just said that about being seen, Jen, because you're totally right. And I started this by saying, if you want to understand cosplay, think about that shirt you love that makes you feel great. And I'll add, you know what feels even better is when you wear that shirt out and someone goes, nice shirt. And you're like, I know! That is exactly the feeling you're talking about, yeah. Jen, when you get to show that off.
Yeah. One of the other things that we saw last year at the Makerspace was people who had never met before would sit down at a table together. They're these big round tables, and all the tools and the materials would be in the center of the table. And they would sit together for the entire weekend, total strangers, and get to know each other and chat while they were making something. And it's just like, I just want to do that all the time. I just want to sit around and like hang out with people and make stuff. And that is exactly what I imagine working in, you know, working on a film or working on a TV show is it's like everybody gets to build something together while you're just like hanging out and you're getting to know this other person. And it was like seeing like the school lunch table. Like people were just, you know, they were enjoying each other's, like watching each other's process.
The spray booth.
Oh, right. When we worked in the spray booth at ILM, we used to call that the room of frank discussion, wasn't it?
You'd sit there painting and drawing and then sharing terrible dating stories from your past.
Yeah, it something about the low hum of the spray booth would just put you in the state of meditation and peace that really made you feel like opening up to whoever's in the room with you.
Yeah. It's somewhere private, like with
yeah.
The
yeah.
One of the things I want to mention is that this is not new to this event, and having Adam be a part of this event has certainly elevated our maker ethos. But when Waz, you know, he was one of the original guys in this when we started it, and his whole background was science and tech, right? And we used to do science fairs for little kids, and Waz was the judge. So imagine being a 10-year-old kid and Steve Wozniak is like, oh, I like your science project, right? And one girl who was there, she's about 10 years old, 12 years old, and she'd gone to a STEM panel. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from her about 10 days after the event, saying that that panel and having Woz judge her science project changed the trajectory of her life. And she wanted to now be a scientist. And that, to me, was one of the most special moments of the entire event. So when we talk about making, yes, it is all of the things we've discussed, but it's also for the artists that come. You know, we have a huge array of some of the best comic book artists out there. And so it's the passion of people who want to draw. It's the passion of people who are drawn to science. And that creativity is everywhere. And so I think one of the things we want to provide is a stage for no matter what your passion is, for everybody to feel like they belong on a stage too.
You know? Yeah, I mean, what Woz has been doing is teaching. He loves teaching. He wants to pass that information on. He wants you to get the same thrill that he got. I've corresponded with Woz, asked him questions about some of the early stuff he's built, and he's always willing to share every last detail of a build if you want to replicate it.
Ultimate perpetual nerd, right?
Everybody's a nerd. This is the thing. You know, you scratch the greatest sports hero in the world and you're going to find out that they're great because they're a super nerd about the sport that they are a genius at. All of this is a journey of self-discovery. To get excellent at anything, your biggest obstacle is yourself. Thus, anytime you get really good at something, it means you've confronted parts of yourself and surpassed them and climbed those mountains. And when we get together and share that journey and exult about what we learned along the way, that's true comradeship, friendship to me.
That creative process, if you're a true creative, you cannot not do it, right?
Yeah.
You have to do it.
It's inherent. People have asked, like, you know, why do you make? And I'm like, because this is the language that I speak. This is the vocabulary with which I interact with the world. And I think that applies across all these different fields that we've talked about, whether it's science or knitting or cooking. Like, you do that because you must. I came out that like the origin question of like, how did you become an artist? It's like, I don't know. I've always been doing this. I've always been making stuff out of, you know, whatever I could find.
It's true. When I was a kid, I used to turn cereal boxes inside out and make models with them.
Yeah, I cut up like plastic packaging.
Yeah, absolute instinct.
It's a great material, cereal box cardboard.
It is. It's perfect.
You know what else is great is the plastic netting that fruit comes in. My God, you can really go to town with that stuff. You can airbrush fish scales with it perfectly.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, just a little tidbit.
You know, it's interesting. Everything you've been talking about is easily accessible stuff that makes brilliant art. That's amazing.
I think it's one of the best things about living in the day and age we live in. When Adam and I grew up, there was no internet. No. When a lot of us grew up, there was no internet. So you had to go to the library and find books, and it was very bleak. It's very difficult to find anything on anything, like mold making is a good example. Now you can go on the internet and go to the Smooth On website, and there is tutorials on how to use all their product. The amount of product that we have to work with now is mind-blowing. You used to have a vacuum chamber to use silicone, but now they have silicone that you don't need a vacuum chamber. That made it very scientific, and now it's accessible.
When we were young model makers, you couldn't buy silicone in an amount smaller than a gallon. That's right. $100 was the minimum threshold to entry, and now SmoothOn has all of these little kits for your small projects.
Yeah. So I think the combination of the internet and the combination of I think the power of all the makers, the fact that everyone is consuming all this product and doing so many things, and the fact that we're so interconnected and there's so many easy ways to connect at conventions and through the internet and exchange ideas and also have that direct connection with the suppliers. They listen, you know, they really respond to what you need as a maker. And there's this community around it that has never existed before at the level that exists now.
It's really cool. As I'm listening to you guys, there's this whole sociological phenomena. You talked about community, communication. It might be the best and last best hope for the savior of society and our civilization, makers.
I don't disagree, but I also want to point out that making is a new term for the oldest human endeavor.
Right.
Right? We are tool makers and we are explorers.
But I think a lot of us, we've lost our way. There's that disconnect.
Yeah, a friend of mine counsels a homeless youth in New York and teaches them a skill. And he said that
and I don't like saying things like kids these days, but he does point out that more than ever before, he has to teach them how to hold a knife in their hand for cooking because no one's ever shown them that before. And yeah, I think it's really important that we use those skills we have as humans inherently and do things with our hands. It connects us to the world in a really abiding way.
Yeah, there was definitely a time during the late 80s and through the 90s where computer technology just kind of took over all fields of work, including ours. I mean, but fortunately for us, it was in the form of 3D printers and laser cutters, you know. But I think that the interesting thing that came out of that is there was a huge fascination with that technology when it was new. It was the new shiny toy. And then people sat in front of their monitors 40, 60 hours a week for weeks on end and years go by. And now I think that's actually driving a lot of the maker movement is the fact that these people want to get away from their monitors. It's not a shiny new toy. Now it's just a utility.
Yeah.
You know, and it, so how do you derive something either creative from that tool or how do you get away from that tool and start working with your hands again? And I think that that's what's driving a lot of people. So the pendulum is now swinging the other direction. It's very fun to watch.
Even to filmmakers like Favreau, who's making The Mandalorian in a very hands-on practical effects kind of way, while at the same time using the latest digital technology.
Yeah, that is the key to the future for sure.
Yeah, so if any of this sounds interesting to you, come to Silicon, right? It's siliconsj.com if you want to go check out and see who's coming and see some of our guests and purchase some tickets. August 27th, 28th, San Jose Convention Center. And I'm Trip Hunter, CEO of Silicon.
I'm Adam Savage, creative director of Silicon. And yeah, if you have the slightest hint of a desire to put on a costume or understand cosplay at a deeper level, come on to our con. Also, bring all makers of all ages. There is, like I said, our threshold to entry is as close to zero as we can make it.
Yeah, just to tack on to what everyone has already said, come build with us. Like, come make with us because we're going to have a great time. And I know that people have been building alone, and we are so excited to, like, build stuff with other people. I'm Jen Schachter, and you can find out more about what I do at jenschachter.com.
I would say come to Silicon because it's a positive experience. I mean, that sounds really, really super simple, but when do you get to go somewhere where everybody wants to be there all at the same time? And that's one of my favorite things about going to cons and going to Silicon specifically, is everyone wants to be there, everyone wants to trade ideas, and it's just the amount of positive energy you feel when you walk into that space is measurable. I don't know what unit of measurement that is, but it's measurable and you could feel it. My name is Fawn Davis, and you can find me at Fawn H. Davis on all social media, and you see all the fun things that I get to build.
Oh my God, you guys, what a wonderful morning. This is great. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Adam Savage's cave on a mysterious street in San Francisco. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkan Songs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.
It was a large room full of people, all kinds. And they had all arrived at the same building at more or less the same time. And they were all free. And they were all asking themselves the same question.